Welcome to HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the top stories and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Monday, April 27th, 2026, and you are listening to episode number 378. We are going to be unpacking all the top stories that dominated the front page yesterday, April 26th.
We have a really incredible lineup today. We are looking at a thought-provoking essay comparing the atrophy of defense manufacturing to the software industry losing its ability to code. We also have a massive update from the Asahi Linux team on their 7.0 release, a literal nightmare scenario where GoDaddy just gave away a company's 27-year-old domain name, a very cautionary tale about an AI agent deleting a production database, and finally, a fun one about a developer who bought the Friendster domain for $30,000 and is trying to bring it back to life.
Let us jump right into that first story. It hit over 1,100 points yesterday. The title is "The West Forgot How to Make Things. Now It Is Forgetting How to Code." The author, Denis Stetskov, draws this brilliant and terrifying parallel between the physical manufacturing world and the current state of software engineering with AI.
Yeah, he starts with this wild anecdote about Raytheon trying to restart Stinger missile production for Ukraine. They literally had to bring back engineers in their 70s to teach younger workers how to build these things from paper schematics drawn back in the Carter administration. They haven't bought a new Stinger in 20 years, and the people who knew how to build them had all retired.
He also brings up Fogbank, which is this classified material used in nuclear warheads. The government shut down the facility in 1989, and when they needed more in 2000, they realized they completely forgot how to make it. They spent $69 million reverse engineering it, only to find out the new batch was too pure. The original had some unintentional impurity that made it work, and that fact was not written down anywhere. It only existed in the heads of the retired workers.
Which brings us to the software parallel. Denis argues that the tech industry is doing the exact same thing right now with AI. We are using AI as a cheap substitute for junior developers, which is effectively cutting off the human pipeline. He points out that rebuilding expertise takes years. You can't just compress a junior developer's journey into a few months by throwing AI at them.
And the Hacker News comments really resonated with this. A user named JW64 had the top comment, pointing out that the real issue is not AI itself, but a management pattern of removing people and organizational slack for short-term profit. They compared it to General Electric hollowing out its long-term capabilities to maximize quarterly shareholder returns.
Exactly. When you remove the slack that experienced engineers need to teach juniors, tacit knowledge stops being transferred. You end up with just documentation and automation, and as the Fogbank story proves, documentation is not the same as field experience. Another commenter pointed out that AI is currently being sold as a productivity tool, but what it is really being used for is workforce reduction.
It is a sobering thought. Code review is already becoming the new bottleneck. AI generates code instantly, but humans still have to review it slowly. And if you do not have seniors who actually understand the systems deeply, you are just one bad day away from a total collapse.
Moving on to our next story, we have a big progress report from the Asahi Linux project, specifically for Linux 7.0. For those who might not know, Asahi is the incredible project porting Linux to Apple Silicon Macs. This post got around 600 points.
The Asahi team always writes the best technical deep dives. This update covered a lot of ground, starting with how they finally automated their installer. For the past 2 years, updating the installer meant someone had to manually run a Rube Goldberg machine of Python scripts and CDN uploads. Now it is all automated through GitHub workflows, which is a huge relief for alternate distro maintainers who rely on those device tree updates.
But the part that really caught my eye was about the ambient light sensor. Apple devices have this True Tone feature that measures both brightness and the color characteristics of the room to adjust the display. Apple being Apple, they offload this to an always-on processor so it doesn't drain the battery. The Asahi team had to figure out how to pull the calibration firmware blob from macOS during installation just to make the Linux driver accurate.
The Hacker News comments zeroed in on a different part of the update regarding the audio chips. A user named Brynet highlighted this amazing bit of sleuthing the Asahi team did. Apple only programs their headphone jack chip to operate at 48 or 96 kilohertz, but the Asahi team looked at the datasheet for a similar chip, guessed that the register layouts might be the same, and managed to unlock 44.1, 88.2, and 192 kilohertz sample rates.
That sparked a big debate in the comments about why Apple locks it down in the first place. Some people speculated it's just a bug that never got prioritized, while others pointed out that 48 kHz is the standard for video and most non-music digital audio. But for Linux users, unlocking 44.1 is huge because it means the audio subsystem doesn't have to waste CPU cycles resampling standard CD quality audio, which actually saves battery life.
It just goes to show how much invisible work goes into making these alternative operating systems function on completely undocumented proprietary hardware. The Asahi team is just on another level.
They really are. Now, Mike, brace yourself for this next one because it is every IT person's worst nightmare. The title is GoDaddy Gave a Domain to a Stranger Without Any Documentation.
Oh man, this one made my blood boil. So a local IT guy in Pennsylvania named Lee Landis was managing a domain for a national nonprofit organization. This domain, which the author anonymized as helpnetworkinc.org, had been in active use for 27 years. Every local chapter at this nonprofit ran their email and website on subdomains of this parent domain.
And then, on a random Saturday afternoon, the domain just vanished from their GoDaddy account. They had dual two-factor authentication enabled. They had GoDaddy's premium domain ownership protection turned on. None of it mattered. The audit log just showed a transfer to another GoDaddy account by an internal user.
Everything went dark. Websites down, emails bouncing. Lee spent the next 4 days making 32 phone calls and spending nearly 10 hours on hold with GoDaddy support. Every time he called, he got a new generic support rep who told him to email a different random inbox, like undo@godaddy.com or artreview@godaddy.com. They kept telling him to just wait a day or two and asking why he thought it was so urgent.
Which is just infuriating. Finally, after 4 days, GoDaddy sent an email saying they determined the new registrant provided the necessary documentation to initiate a change of account, and they considered the matter closed. They did not show Lee the documentation, they just told him to get a lawyer if he was unhappy. The nonprofit had to completely migrate to a new domain, losing 27 years of SEO and breaking every email address they had ever printed on marketing materials.
The Hacker News comments were absolutely ruthless, and rightfully so. A user named SamD73 posted a timeline of GoDaddy scandals, going back to them issuing thousands of unvalidated SSL certificates, injecting JavaScript into customer websites, and extorting their own users when domains expire.
Yeah, the consensus in the comments was basically asking why anyone still uses GoDaddy. A lot of people speculated this was either a social engineering attack that tricked a low-level support rep or an inside job. But the real failure is the complete lack of an escalation path. When a catastrophic mistake happens, you cannot just have the customer screaming into the void of tier one support tickets. It is a massive cautionary tale about where you register your critical domains.
Speaking of cautionary tales, our next story is titled An AI Agent Deleted Our Production Database. The agent's confession is below. This was a Twitter thread posted by a developer named Jeremy Crane that got over 500 points on Hacker News.
So Jeremy gave an AI agent access to their staging environment for what he called a routine task. But they had commingled their credentials, and the agent ended up executing a volume delete command that wiped their actual production database. But the part that really got Hacker News fired up was that Jeremy then went back to the AI and demanded to know why it did it, and then posted the AI's response as a confession.
Oh, the comments absolutely tore him apart for that. The top comment by a user named 827A said anyone who follows up a mistake like that by demanding a confession from an agent is not mature enough to be using these tools. Calling it a confession is so cringe because the agent is not alive. It cannot learn from its mistakes in that context.
Exactly. Another commenter, Triple E, said the headline should really be, "I deleted our production database using AI." You cannot blame the AI any more than you can blame SSH.
It is so true. Millions of years of evolutionary wiring make us want to anthropomorphize these chatbots, especially when they reply in the first person. But at the end of the day, it is just a statistical model generating tokens.
To be fair to Jeremy, he did point out a major infrastructure flaw that contributed to this. They were using a hosting provider called Railway, and it turns out the API token creation flow gave them no warning that the token had blanket authority across the entire GraphQL API, including destructive operations.
Right. But as the comments pointed out, if you are integrating an API, especially giving it to an autonomous agent, you have to verify the scopes yourself. You cannot just assume it is sandboxed. It is a harsh lesson in the principle of least privilege. Do not give your AI agent the keys to the kingdom unless you are fully prepared for it to accidentally burn the castle down.
Let us wrap up today with something a bit more lighthearted. The title is, I bought Friendster for $30,000. Here's what I'm doing with it.
I loved this one. So the author, Mike Carson, is in the domain name business. He noticed that Friendster.com, which had been dead since 2015, was suddenly resolving to a page full of spammy pop-up ads. He tracked down the owner, who had apparently bought it at an expired domain auction on a Chinese registrar site for just $7,400.
Which is incredibly cheap for a piece of internet history like Friendster. Mike ended up buying it from that guy for $20,000 in Bitcoin, plus another domain name worth about $10,000. He even managed to secure the expiring trademarks.
So he owns Friendster, and he wanted to build something positive, remembering how fun the early days of social media were. He built a basic social network, but people were not really sticking around. But then he got a suggestion from a previous Hacker News post to make it so you can only connect with friends if you physically tap your phones together in real life.
I think that is such a brilliant concept. It completely eliminates bots and forces actual human connection. But of course, he ran into the Apple App Store review process. Apple rejected the initial version under Guideline 4.2, minimum functionality. They told him the usefulness of the app was limited because it was intended for a niche set of users who had to be invited in person.
The comments on Hacker News were very critical of Apple's walled garden here. User 0xbadcafeb pointed out that Apple should not be able to dictate what you use your phone for, and that it does not work that way for PCs. But another user chimed in with a really helpful tip about unlisted app distribution, which is a special form you can file with Apple to bypass some of these niche app restrictions.
Mike eventually got the app approved by allowing anyone to sign up, but keeping the phone tapping requirement to actually make a connection. He is even adding features where connections fade over time if you do not tap phones again within a year. It is a really beautiful anti-algorithmic approach to social media.
It really is. It takes us back to the roots of what social networks were supposed to be, connecting with actual people. I might have to download it and find someone to tap phones with.
Same here. Well, that is all we have for today's episode of HN Pod. It's always fascinating to see how these stories intersect, from losing tacit knowledge in manufacturing to losing domains and databases in the cloud.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Make sure to tune in tomorrow for another breakdown of the top stories from Hacker News. Have a great day.